Welcome back to the National Defense. It's Randy Miller. Man, I love talking about music, and I love talking about old music. I love it because, you know, that's the kind of music we grew up with. And especially with our audience, I mean, you guys, especially the Vietnam vet era guys, this is kind of the soundtrack of your life for a while. And I'm talking about some of these great groups like Crosby, Stills and Nash and Joni Mitchell, and especially one that we're talking about today. And there's a new book out called All the Leaves Are Brown. Scott Shea is the author, and he's here with us. Scott, how are you?
Hey, Randy, how are you doing? Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, this is all about the mamas and the papas, how the mamas and papas came together and broke apart. And it's fascinating, some of the stuff that we did not know about the mamas and the papas, and some of the things that have been said about them along the way that are just rumors and totally untrue. How did you get involved? What is your kind of, you know, interest and association with this group?
Well, you know, I am a producer at SiriusXM for the Catholic Channel, and I had done a series of audio documentaries that aired nationally for the channel, and I wanted to move into writing a book for myself about music, because that's, like you said, it's what I love. I love it. I love listening to old music. And, you know, I was reading a lot of folk rock musicians, reading a lot about him. I had read, you know, about Bob Dylan, tons of books out there about him, and then was reading about Gene Clark of the Byrds, a great book about him, and I had finished reading up Peter Ames Carlin's book on Paul Simon, really great book, and I was like, well, I'd like to read about the mamas and the papas. You know, they were folk rock, kind of moving in onto the next subject, or John Phillips particularly, and couldn't really find anything written in this century. You know, there's a few books out there, but it had been almost 20 years since something had been written about them. And John and Michelle both put out competing autobiographies in the mid 80s, but you know, I kind of wanted a narrative nonfiction. I wanted something that a book that I would like to read. I wanted to write a book that I would like to read. That's the way you write. You write in the style you write. You read, and decided, hey, if there's no book about them, I'll write about them. I was looking for a subject, and boom, it hit me right on the head.
Wow. Well, we're talking to Scott Shea here on the National Defense. His book, All the Leaves Are Brown, and it's the story of how the mamas and papas came together and broke apart. And of course, you know, you mentioned, and then this was kind of it was such a cool era of music, Scott. You know, this is that whole Laurel Canyon vibe and all the house parties and Jackson Brown, Linda Ronstadt, Joni Mitchell. I mean, this kind of coalesced all together, didn't it?
Yeah, this is really kind of the beginning of that era, you know, it had always kind of been an artistic community, that Laurel Canyon, but it was mostly actors. But by the mid 60s, a lot of the musicians were moving into those houses, you know, because the music industry had really moved from New York to Los Angeles at that time. And so you got the members of the Byrds and Frank Zappa and all these people living up there in the Hollywood Hills because they're making money now. That's kind of where the mamas and the papas fell into. It was really the dawn of that era, and all the others followed. And, you know, like you said, Joni Mitchell and Graham Nash and David Crosby and so many others.
Okay. So let's get into this a little bit here, Scott. So you got John Phillips, his wife, Michelle Phillips, Denny Doherty, and, Cass Elliot didn't come along immediately, right?
Right. John was, you know, in the aftermath of the Beatles coming and the British invasion, it kind of eviscerated the folk music scene. And this is just like pure folk music, you know, acoustic guitars, guys with short haircuts on the stage, you know, and suits.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, and that's all the mamas and the papas and all those young guys I mentioned before, like the members of the Byrds and Stephen Stills and so many others were part of that. They had kind of gravitated to that in the late 50s and early 60s, and this kind of grew out of all that, you know. So John had been in the Journeyman, They were recorded for Capitol. Jenny had been in Halifax 3. They recorded for Epic. And Cass had been in the Big 3. And they recorded for a tiny label called FM. And, you know, when that got blown out of the water by the Beatles, you know, they John, Michelle, and Denny and a few others went to the Virgin Islands to try to regroup and refresh and figure out what they wanted to do. They weren't stars yet. They were far from it at that point. And Cass was in love with Denny. She had, you know, known him as when he was in his folk group, and they had toured together, and she eventually followed him there. You know,
why the Virgin Islands? Why, I mean, of all places.
They were looking for some place to go. John was particularly fond of the Caribbean. He had gone to Cuba there before the fall of before the rise of Castro, you know, in early 1960 or late 59 or something like that. And he loved going there. And the story goes that they blindfolded Michelle and had her point to some place on the map, and she ended up pointing to the U.S. Virgin Islands. So they said, you know, said, okay, let's go with it. Sounds great. You know, I don't know if that story is necessarily true, but that's the one they tell. And and you know, it's a great place. It's all, you know, it's also U.S. territory, so it's not like you are gonna have running water probably, you know,
right.
And things like that. So so they went, and then, you know, Cass got wind that Denny was there, and she followed him, and, you know, she wanted to be part of this whatever they were doing. And John was very resistant to that because he really wanted to kind of do a Peter, Paul, and Mary type of thing. And didn't have a room for a fourth person, but she kept at it. And when they ended up in Los Angeles auditioning for groups, she would accompany them to the auditions. And, you know, Lou Adler said, you know, I want the four of you. I don't want the three of you, especially when they heard her sing and how she sang along with them, you know. So,
well, I mean, I can't even imagine, you know, without Cass. We're talking to Scott Shea here in the National Defense. All the Leaves Are Brown. How the Mamas and Papas Came Together and Broke Apart is the new book. And now, so how about Michelle? So Michelle was not a part of a group before this. Was she just hot?
Well, she definitely was hot.
Yeah.
She was a model. You know, a professional model. She modeled mostly in like JCPenney catalogs and stuff like that. But she actually was in the New Journeymen when John reformed them. And I think it served kind of a dual purpose, because she had, you know, early on into their marriage, they got married in 1962, and very early on she had an affair, and they reconciled. And I think he brought her in as a way to kind of keep an eye on her, you know, so it get her involved and keep an eye on her. But she was in that group, you know, that group never signed with the label. They did a bunch of touring. There's footage of them singing together. You know, you can find it on YouTube. The three of them, very young and much more clean shaven. But she wasn't a singer, though. You know, she had to take singing lessons. But John was able to always really kind of get the best out of her. She wasn't featured too much in the Mamas and the Papas, but she, you know, she does sing that opening to Dedicated to the One I Love. And
yeah,
John always made very good use of her voice. So when I love hearing what he was able to do with her, because he could take people who couldn't sing and make them sound good.
Well, I mean, Michelle Phillips played a very mean tambourine, and
yeah, right.
And then she went and had another a little dalliance with a guy from the Byrds, and her husband fired her from the band, right?
Yeah, it was Gene Clark. He had actually left the Byrds shortly before that all happened, and you know, John and Michelle, it came right after John found out that Michelle and Denny had a thing going on. John moved in with Denny, believe it or not, moving with the guy. And so she was left alone at their home. And she was introduced to Gene Clark through a mutual friend. And they started kind of a secret romance that John eventually found out about and fired her for a couple of months, replaced her with Jill Gibson, who was Lou Adler, their producer, his girlfriend at the time. She had dated Jan Berry of Jan and Dean before that.
Wow.
And she was a very musical person. She was a very artistic person. She wrote a bunch of the songs with Jan Berry, and even sang background, and he even produced a single on her. So, and she was a pretty blonde ex-model to herself, so she fit on paper, she fit in perfectly. But, you know, only after a couple months, I think everybody just realized that there was no replacing Michelle, that, yeah. you know, the members of the group weren't like a cog that could be easily replaced. You know, you had to they were a shared experience. And Michelle had an edge to her that Jill just didn't have. And they brought her back in.
I just watched a YouTube clip of their performance at the Monterey Pop Festival, which they had originally. I mean, they were the driving force kind of behind that, right?
Yeah, John was, John and Michelle especially, Cass and Denny not so much, but John really, the idea was presented to him by a couple of promoters in Los Angeles, and he kind of took it and ran with it. He turned it into a not-profit thing, which allowed him to get a lot of great artists, and he really went for cutting edge. You know, he was trying, you know, he didn't want it to be like Dick Clark's Caravan of Stars, which nothing against those were great shows, you know, sure. But he wanted it to be a little more cutting edge, a little more youthful. He saw the way music was trending. You know, he wanted rock and roll to reach the level of respectability that jazz and folk music enjoyed. And I think, you know, the Monterey Pop really helped that. And he was able to get, you know, the groups from San Francisco who are really just starting to bubble under the surface, like Jefferson Airplane and the Grateful Dead and Big Brother and the Holding Company with Janis Joplin and Quicksilver Messenger Service. And you know, they were able to get Otis Redding and The Who and the Jimi Hendrix Experience out of England, you know. And right as these people, right on the dawn of their breaking into superstars. So it's just, you know, when you look back with the benefit of time, you know, you really see that it was an incredible festival he put together.
Was that the festival, too, where Bob Dylan first used electric guitar?
No, that was at the Newport Folk Festival. Ah. That would have been a couple of years earlier. Bob Dylan was not at the Monterey Pop Festival.
Okay, all right. and man, people turned on him for that.
Oh, yeah. I think Pete Seeger tried to cut the electric wire with an axe or something. <You know>? He was so pissed off.
Rock and roll, man. Rock and roll.
It brings out the best and the worst in all of us.
We're talking to Scott Shea here in the National Defense, his book, All the Leaves Are Brown, How the Mamas and Papas Came Together and Broke Apart. And you talked to a ton of people for this book, right?
I did a good bit. You know, I didn't talk to hundreds of people. I probably talked to dozens. But, you know, I was able to talk with Dick Wiseman, who was John's bandmate in The Journeyman, who's still with us and still very lucid and very involved in the music scene in Colorado. And he knows John Phillips inside and out like a book. You know, he's almost like a walking encyclopedia. And they were friends. You know, they stayed in touch through the years up until his death, you know. And I also talked with Pat LaCroix, who was in Denny's folk group, the Halifax 3, and I did talked with Joe Gibson, you know, who replaced Michelle there for a couple months, and a few other industry people from back in those days who were on their recording sessions or involved with the label.
And they used to, you know, that first trip to the U.S. Virgin Islands, I guess, really kind of started something with them, because they went back a lot, and they finally did get kicked off the Virgin Islands, right?
They did. Their trip there, they had a lot of unpaid bills and were just eventually becoming a nuisance to the community.
The mamas and the papas are back.
And the mayor of the mayor's nephew, he got high with them and had like a bad acid trip. And once that got back to the mayor, he's like, get off my island.
you say they vacationed on the island for about 5 months. They took LSD every day, grew marijuana. Yep. And Michelle got arrested for speeding on a Yamaha with no plates and fighting with a police officer.
Yep, it's all in the book. I think people are going to really enjoy it. It's action-packed.
and finally, and I've heard this over the years, it's not true that Mama Cass choked on a ham sandwich.
No, it's a vicious rumor that it started by accident, really. And she actually died of heart failure just from, you know, years of prolonged drug use and yo-yo dieting.
Yeah, I mean, that thing just stuck around and still sticks around forever. But
it's still there.
Hey, Scott, thanks for talking, man. That's what a fascinating book this is, and best of luck with it.
Thank you, Randy. I appreciate you having me on.
We'll be right back here on the National Defense.